Hi, honey. I'm sorry I didn't get around to writing sooner, but it's been a real busy long trip.
In the summer of 1967, U.S. Air Force Major Stanley Horn left his home in Madison, Wisconsin, on his way to Thailand and Karat Air Base. He would be stationed there as the pilot of an F-105 Thunder Chief, a supersonic tactical fighter bomber. His mission would be to drop bombs on targets in North Vietnam.
It really kept us busy since we left San Francisco.
This tape, the one you're hearing now, is one of dozens of reel-to-reel tapes Major Horn recorded and sent home to his wife, Jerry. And in Madison, Jerry Horn recorded her own.
This is Monday, and the kids have gone back to school after a nice but rather uneventful weekend. The weather is beautiful here.
Anyway, I guess I should start at the beginning and tell you what's happened. I recorded this whole message once.
Major Horn was a veteran pilot. He volunteered for the war in Vietnam, but had never before seen combat.
Really, a very, very lonely assignment. It's not like it was in Alaska, you know, when I went up there. It was lonely there, too, but I know it wasn't for very long. Here, I know it can be up to a year, and it's been 1 month today that I left.
In 1967, Major Stanley Horn and his wife, Jerry, were raising a family. They had three sons and a daughter. Jeff, 9 years old, Susan, six, Scott, three, and Kevin, just a year old.
Now remember, this is all new to us, so don't expect too much. We have been practicing, but
as the wife of a military officer, Jerry Horn knew her role and played it well. She ran the household, cared for the four young children, managed their lives while her Air Force husband flew missions over North Vietnam.
The mailman was just here, and my morale is good for another day. I got another letter from you, and in your letter you mentioned that it's been quite a while since you've heard from me. Well, honey, I have been writing, but maybe not often enough.
These tapes passed halfway around the world, back and forth regularly for several months. But as each of the tapes arrived in Madison from the airbase in Thailand, there was more evidence of a changing man. The incremental signs of a soldier being altered by warfare.
I haven't spoken to you very much in this vein lately, Jerry. But what we're doing right now is almost impossible to believe. We're going in mission after mission. There's two missions a day and day after day. And losing from 2 to 4 airplanes every time we go in, 20 airplanes at a time.
In November of 1967, Major Horn's squadron was experiencing big losses. Men they knew, lived with, flew with, were dying.
We've lost 20 air crews in less than 6 weeks. And we, of course, can't keep us up. The loss ratio is just astronomical. That's 1/3 of our squadron in 6 weeks.
On January 14, 1968, Major Stanley Horn left the U.S. Air Base in Karat, as he had done many times, piloting his F-105D single-pilot Thunder Chief.
Maybe I'm just one of the luckier people. But I'm going to come out of this, and I know it.
On this morning, the mission would again be over Vietnam, as it had always been. But this time, at a point on the Red River near the city of Yen Bay, Major Horn's plane would be shot down.
I regret the people, the friends that I lose. It's making an entirely different man out of me, watching this go on. And like everybody else, I don't know, you know, how long can it go on?
Major Stanley Horn was 41 years old.
Please don't worry about us. We are all just fine and getting along fine, too. It does get pretty lonely without you, but I try to keep as busy as I can. And so far, I've had no trouble on that score. Kevin sees to that. But it's not just him. The others keep me busy, too. And then there's always the little things that come along to fill my days. Things that probably you would be taking care of if you were here. But honestly,
Jerry Horn remembers the day she received the word.
Well, you know, somebody comes to your door. Yeah, comes to your door and they have things in their hand, papers and things. And I don't know, I guess I just was thinking, I don't know what this is about, you know. And he pretty much just got right into it because there's no way you can, you know, make it an easy thing. And I'm sure it was hard for him to do, but it was a shock. It was a shock. I couldn't believe what I was being told.
I was one of the strike pilots in a formation of probably 16 airplanes. Stan was the number two airplane, flying a D model, a single-seat airplane.
Captain Earl Henderson was one of Stanley's best friends. He was in the same squadron, the 469th, and on the same mission, a mile away in his own F-105, the day Major Horn's plane was shot out of the sky.
And a MiG-21 comes swooping down out of high altitude, probably doing 1.2, 1.3 Mach. And of course, the guy, the MiG pilot, fires an ATOL missile with a perfect solution from 6 o'clock. The missile impacts his airplane. The airplane starts coming apart, and Stan ejects immediately. And as I'm headed home, within a few minutes, it's obvious that Stan's airplane is the one that's down. And of course, I'm just absolutely devastated because I know it's Stan, and I just can't believe it's happened.
Scotty just woke up from his nap, and he's standing next to me. He says he wants to say something to you. We tried to get him to say something on some of our practice tapes, and he wouldn't. But maybe he will now. Let's see. Just a minute now.
Hi, Dad. Hi. How are you, Dad?
What have you been doing lately?
Knowing my husband, I just thought he will come back. I just, yeah, if anybody could, he will. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that he would.
Where's Daddy?
He's on a trip.
Yes, and how long is he going to be gone, do you know?
3 days.
No, he's going to be gone a little longer than that. How long do you think Daddy's going to be gone?
He's going to be longer than that.
Yes, it sure is, isn't it? But we think about it.
As of this moment, we don't know what we're fighting, and this is part of a warfare. But we will figure it out. And we'll lose some more airplanes before we do. It won't be me. Don't worry.
Months went by. No more news. Nothing more about Stanley Horn. He was officially listed by the military as missing in action. In 1968, the days and weeks came and went. Children's birthdays came and went. The war continued. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Robert Kennedy was gunned down. Protesters against the war were beaten by Chicago police outside the Hilton Hotel, where the Democratic National Convention was held.
America couldn't fight no more war.
And then a new year, 1969. And thousands of miles from where Major Horn's aircraft was intercepted by a North Vietnamese fighter pilot, two young California girls were meeting with a number of women whose husbands were listed as missing in action by the U.S. government.
It's sort of an unlikely story and so much by accident.
Carol Bates Brown, along with her friend Kay Hunter, had been part of a campus organization called Voices in Vital America, a group Carol says was trying to do positive things at a time when campuses were fertile ground for unrest.
We also had a friend, was Bob Dornan, who was a local television personality in Los Angeles at the time. He later went on and served many years in Congress. Anyway, he introduced these women, and he had a bracelet he had gotten from the Montagnards in Vietnam. And he said he was wearing that to remember what the people of Vietnam were going through at the time with the war all around them. And my friend and I decided it'd be really cool if we could get Montagnard bracelets to wear to remember the men who were POWs and MIAs. And of course, you had to go to Vietnam sort of to get a Montagnard bracelet. We tried to figure out ways to do that. Nobody wanted to send two, sorority girls to Vietnam in the middle of the war. So we decided we would maybe look into making our own.
Carol and Kay were able to persuade friends to donate metal, and they found an engraver
who did mainly horse jewelry, the fancy silver for horses that are in parades and all. And he made these bracelets for us, these little test bracelets, and he engraved the names. And the original bracelets just had the name, rank, and date of loss on them. At the time, it didn't occur to us to put anything more on it, and it just really took off. Maybe other kids at school would want to wear them. And like I said, it went from just the two of us wanting to have bracelets into something where I think we distributed 5 million bracelets between 1970 and 1975.
On Veterans Day in 1970, the official bracelets were released. And etched on one of them was the name Major Stanley Horn, U.S. Air Force, January 14th, 1968. In the early going, it's not clear how many of the Horn bracelets were made and distributed, but people had them and wore them, including his fellow squadron pilot Earl Henderson and Stanley's wife, Jerry.
It was our way of remembering our husbands and waiting for them to come back and being sure that they were going to come back because we were wearing their bracelets. And, we all pretty much did it.
For Jerry, who after more than a year had little else but the harsh reality that Stanley had been shot down, the bracelet was a symbol of faith, a bracelet of grace.
I actually felt like I saw the hope in that bracelet. If I kept wearing it, he would come back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think a lot of people felt that way about their bracelets.
In the air war, American planes shot down the communist MiG over North Vietnam, the 18th of the war. The Defense Department today released...
Beginning in 1967, news of the war in Vietnam was nearly always the lead story on the nightly evening news.
In South Vietnam, there were 15...
By 1970, the war dominated American life, avoiding its costs at home and in Southeast Asia were nearly impossible.
In Gia Dinh, a grenade was thrown into a jeep and five Americans were hurt.
And at the same time in California, Carol Bates Brown, a student at Cal State Northridge, and her friend Kay Hunter at UCLA had an engraver friend make 10 sample POW MIA bracelets.
Because they had a name on them, it gave you this one-to-one connection.
They were quickly finding out how popular their bracelets were becoming.
And people really, really connected with that. And, they said, oh, my guy. They would refer to him as my guy.
Carol and Kay needed to fund the bracelet idea. They asked Ross Perot, the millionaire businessman from Texas, but nothing ever came of it. They even visited Howard Hughes in Las Vegas. Nothing there. Then the husband of a friend, sympathetic to the cause, donated brass and copper, enough to make 1,200 bracelets.
And then people like Sonny and Cher went on their television show one day and showed their bracelets.
Well, I don't know. Well, that's true.
We'd had other people on television shows showing their bracelets too, but certainly they caught the attention of the younger people.
They sold them for $2.50. That meant money coming in now. And after they officially kicked off the bracelet program on Veterans Day, November 11, 1970, more donors offered money to help. And soon Carol and Kay were receiving 12,000 requests for the bracelets every day.
We had a little office to begin with, but we outgrew that office and we had to hire a lot of people, including a lot of grown-ups. But one of the biggest things was we actually forwarded all this mail to the families. We had 10 or 15 people that did nothing but forward mail every day from bracelet wearers to the families.
And some of that mail was getting to Jerry Horn.
It gave me more hope. If they supported him, maybe there was a chance that he would be back and I really counted on that.
The letters from those wearing Major Horn's POW MIA bracelet came frequently, and Jerry read every one many times over and kept them all together safe in a drawer in her bedroom. They came from all over the country. Teresa Mapes of Carthage, Illinois, Jenny Light of Weston, Connecticut, Michael Jones of Patriot, Indiana, Mrs. Janet Davis of Southern Pines, North Carolina, Judy Skai of Syracuse, New York, Debbie Crane of Glendale, Arizona. As more bracelets were distributed, more letters came, including one from 15-year-old Allison McIntosh of Hollis, New York, in Queens.
To the family of Major Stanley Horn, the POW MIA bracelet with Major Horn's name on it is proudly worn by me, Allison McIntosh. I have worn his bracelet for almost a month now, and I can say I am proud of him and what he has done.
Allison now lives in the Catskill Mountains, and like so many others, still has her bracelet. During a recent talk over Skype, she held it in her hand and smiled when she spoke of those letters she sent to Jerry Horn almost 40 years ago.
I remember I wore it every day. I mean, the inside of this has a little, not rust, because they're made quite well, but you can tell that the inside band here is a little worn off. I remember wearing it every day, every day. And he became my soldier.
I've gotten a lot of nice letters from people, and very encouraging, and I could tell they actually believed what they were saying in their letters.
For reasons Jerry Horn can't explain, Allison's letters stood out from the rest. And although Jerry wrote return thank you letters through Viva, the organization representing the bracelets and the families, to nearly all the bracelet wearers who mailed letters to her, there was something about Allison's letters that prompted a back-and-forth exchange, lasting for more than a year.
I do remember her letter and her telling me all about him and the family. And I can't believe, I don't even remember that I wrote that many times. And my handwriting was a lot better then.
One letter, 6 pages, single-spaced and handwritten, addressed to Allison's home, was never sent. Nearly 40 years later, Allison finally was able to read that letter.
Dear Allison, I can't possibly put into words how happy and how grateful I was to receive your letter. I have shared it with my children and other members of my family, and they have all asked that I extend their thanks to you for writing.
She really personalized the letter. I mean, she took the time, you know, in all the things that she had to do with her kids and worrying about her husband not being there, she took the time to write an extensive letter to me and detail out every, you know, different parts of what they were doing and how they were feeling. And it really, you know, I could see connection with it even more now being an adult. It brought me into what their life was, and it must have been pretty crazy at that time.
Please remember to say your prayers every day for Stanley. I know it will help. Thank you again, Allison, for taking the time to care.
It's terrible to feel alone in a situation like this. So it was nice. That was really good. Keep in touch in that way.
Yes, I was always hoping that possibly she was going to, you know, send me another letter saying that he was home. I remember always waiting to see, get that letter and say, oh, he's home with his kids now. But, of course, that didn't happen for a lot of them.
Allison now keeps a copy of the unsent letter next to her bracelet. And Jerry Horn, despite dozens of letters and the bracelets she and each of her children were wearing, for months and years, there was still no news on her husband. After the official release of the POW MIA bracelets, the country was becoming increasingly aware of the depth of the missing and captured in Vietnam. And on January 18, 1970, Jerry Horn was the subject of a story in the Wisconsin State Journal newspaper entitled A New Kind of Unknown Soldier. But this was Madison, Wisconsin, the home of the University of Wisconsin, a campus that had been shaken by student protests, some violent. The tension prompted the newspaper to disguise Jerry Horn's identity, using fictitious names throughout the story.
I was very careful about who knew my situation and who didn't, because I didn't want to open myself up for any harassment.
In Madison at the time, a military family could have been targeted.
So I was very careful about what I said and to whom I said it.
Then, months later, from the depths of military intelligence, a sliver of hope, word that Major Stanley Horn just might be alive.
There was a thing called a tactical analysis bulletin that came out like once a month out of Langley. And they had a section on POWs, and suddenly his name showed up in the category of probable POW.
Major Horn's friend and fellow squadron pilot, Captain Earl Henderson.
And until that time, I had always mentally carried him in the MIA category. And so I called Langley and I said, is this accurate? Is this correct? And I talked to the sergeant and I'm on a secure line. And he says, well, yes, of course. And I said, well, the family has no idea about this. And he said, oh, you can't tell the family. I said, this is highly classified and blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, this is it's for damn important, you know. And so he cautioned me. And I thought about it quite a bit. And so I ended up calling Jerry. And I said, Jerry, you know, I think I've got some good news. I said, I just read a report that says Stan is a probable POW. God almighty, I wish I'd never made that call.
It's Christmas. I'm lonely, unhappy at being here alone. Wish so much that I was home with you. You can't even imagine.
This reel-to-reel tape of the many Major Horn sent home to Madison was one of the last.
Those Christmas cards were tremendous. The ones with the picture of the children. Jeff looked so much bigger.
Years later, his children listened to many of these tapes for the first time. The youngest son, Kevin.
It's really emotional. It really is. I couldn't believe that I actually heard my father say my name and say that. I've never heard that in my life, and here I am 43 years old.
The one of Scott and Kevin is outstanding. My gosh, he's grown so much I couldn't believe it.
Listening to these tapes reminded the children of those days of waiting for news on their father and how important their POW MIA bracelet was to each of them.
Mom sent away, got a shipment of five or six of the bracelets.
Jeff is the oldest of the three sons.
When she gave them out, I think we all started wearing them.
The children also remember the letters that kept coming for several years from all those who wore their father's bracelet. This is Susan.
I remember, you know, quite a few of them, but I seem to remember there being quite a few more. But I just remember stacks of them.
Wow. And what do you remember your mother doing with them? Do you remember her sitting at the table?
Yeah. I remember opening them. I remember her writing back to quite a few. I remember her reading them to me.
And as those letters continued to be delivered to the Horn mailbox in Madison, Jerry and the family hung on to the hope that had come from Captain Earl Henderson.
To be in a category of probable POW, it generally means a human sighting.
But time kills hope. Son Kevin.
Every once in a while, we'd be notified that a report was going to be coming out or an update on the POW situation. And I remember my mom always being really hopeful to hear some kind of nugget of information or some type of evidence or something. But nothing ever came. We never, ever got a single piece of evidence of anything about my father. Nothing.
Here again is Jeff.
Yeah, there was disillusionment. Families of people who they believed to be POWs were allowed to send things to them. Box up, I'm not even sure, candy bars or things you could send. You know, the first several boxes my mom sent went over and we never heard anything. After maybe a year or so, we started getting a couple back returned.
I'm Bill Buttel, ABC News, New York. Tonight, Senator McGovern says President Nixon is taking the low road.
By 1972, there were signs the war was ending in Vietnam.
Sergeant Shriver says again, President.
And in January of 1973, the Paris Peace Accords.
The following statement is being issued at this moment in Washington and Hanoi. At 12:30 Paris time today, January 23, 1973, the agreement on ending the war.
A month later, in February of 73,
the first group of American prisoners released under the Vietnam peace
North Vietnam agreed to release 591 American POWs.
An opportunity to call home, to sleep in good beds, and to eat the kind of dinners never known.
But when the list of those POWs was released, the name of U.S. Air Force Major Stanley Horn was not there.
And I'll never forget it because she sat me and Scott down. She had already told Jeff. She said, "You know, I want you to know that there's a list of people coming home, and we wanted your daddy to be on that, but he's not on that list."
Through it all, even after the war was officially over, Stanley Horn's wife, children, and friend Earl Henderson continued to wear the Major's bracelet, and so did others all over the country. Susan Hall of Indianapolis, Indiana. Ann Coleman of Fayetteville, North Carolina, Debbie Block of LaGrange, Kentucky, Roseanne Garcia of Warwick, Rhode Island. Then in November of that year, the Defense Department, for reasons unclear, again changed the status of Major Horn, reclassifying him as missing in action.
My theory is he reached the ground alive.
Squadron colleague Earl Henderson.
And was alive for a period of time. It could have been a day, it could have been a year, who knows.
Despite the peace accords and the release of the POWs, the fighting in Southeast Asia continued. On April 30th, 1975, Saigon fell.
This is a historic moment, the arrival of the North Vietnamese Regular Army in Saigon, right in the middle of Saigon.
The figures marking the human cost of the war varied, but about 3.5 million Vietnamese on both sides lost their lives, nearly 2 million in Laos and Cambodia, and more than 58,000 U.S. soldiers. In 1975, it was still not clear if Major Stanley Horn was one of the dead.
That he will unconditionally hand over to the new regime.
Wife, Jerry Horn.
You have to resign yourself to the fact that this is the way it's going to be. And I think I did that pretty good.
In the mid-1980s, when the relations between the U.S. and Vietnam began to improve, the Vietnamese government began to slowly return American remains that had been collected or stored. The Horn family was contacted in April of 1990. There had been 10 sets of remains that had been turned over to the U.S. by the Socialist Republic of Vietnam.
Easter Day of 1990, Jeff called me, and he said, well, we have to talk.
Stanley Horn's son, Scott.
I just was flushed. I didn't know really what to say. It took a while for it to really sink in, you know.
And I just remember crying and completely breaking down.
It was shocking, but the only thing that mattered to me was the closure that was given to my mom.
Up until that point, she still had hope.
She sure did.
I mean, she's still 22 years later, she still had hope. A military wife doesn't give up hope until the body's returned.
John Pepitone reports that for his family, today's service ends years of not knowing what happened.
Hundreds came to pay tribute to the Madison pilot, who was missing in action until last April, when his remains.
It's just a sad thing to, you know, you have to have a service, but it's sad, and it's hard to go through, but it was nice.
There are no words of mine this morning that can reverse.
At the service, Jerry and her children wore their bracelets.
I still get it out. Every once in a while, I'll be thinking of him, and I'll wear it for a week or so. Yeah, so.
You still have it?
Yeah,
where
I still have it? I keep it in my jewelry box.
And every so often, you do what?
Yeah, I get it out and wear it for a week or so, week or 2 weeks. I'll either just see it there, or I'll be thinking about him, or, you know, I'll just, I'll be telling a story to my kids about him or about growing up, and it just makes me think about him, and I'll just get it out and wear it.
Once again, Earl Henderson.
When I read that his body had returned in 1990, you know, that's when I took the bracelet off.
This drive from the Horn home in Madison to Roselawn Memorial Park and the crypt of Major Stanley Horn is like many you'd see in a small town, some strip malls and a church or two, a few houses. But it's a long way from the jungles of North Vietnam. More than 1,700 Americans are still listed as missing or unaccounted for from the war. And unlike the Horns, many families are still looking for closure, still wearing their bracelets. After the funeral service, Jerry Horn took off the bracelet that carried her husband's name, but she knows she'll never be without it.
They can put it in the casket with me. That would be fine too. Just leave it on my wrist.